describe for our listeners what is the WOW Cafe Theater, Women's One World, and talk about your journey to it.
The WOW Cafe Theater, which I usually just refer to in shorthand as WOW, is a long-running women and trans person theater collective in the Lower East Side of New York. It was launched in 1982, and it's still running. And it is open to all women and trans people. And I got involved with it when I moved to New York. I was in New York for a couple of years before I found my way to the WOW Cafe, actually to a party in the East Village. It was a Christmas party. It was called a double X-rated Christmas party for women. There was a great poster. I thought, wow, this looks fun and weird in a good way. Mm-hmm. And I went there and I kind of never left. It was a really wonderful, exciting group of women who were making outrageous work, who were very warm and welcoming, who were kind of breaking the rules. And I had been looking for a sense of a community, and particularly sort of a feminist community. And I found like I, you know, this was my sorority.
When I was reading this, towards the beginning, one of your essays, you actually wrote the statement, WOW saved my life. I wondered if you could elaborate on that.
When I said WOW saved my life is that I came of age in a place where I couldn't access a feminist and LGBT movement, a time at, although I loved my time at K College, it was great, and I really have fond memories of it. It was like before we had women's studies, for example, really struggling with trying to figure out who I was in the world. And it wasn't just personal questions about my sexuality. It was larger questions about identity and a larger political landscape and of feminism and what was then known as like the gay liberation movement helped put my personal struggles in a larger political context. And that helped me enormously. So I would be, before I was in WOW, I was part of something called the New York Feminist Art Institute in 1979, and we used consciousness raising as an art making tool. So we'd sit in a circle and everybody would share about a topic, which could be your relationship with your father or your relationship with your body. And suddenly questions like your obsession about your weight seemed to be a larger issue when you heard 25 people all saying, my life would be so much better if I lost 25 pounds. So I had gained, you know, some insights from reading about feminism, reading about gay liberation. Going to the WOW Cafe helped me make a connection between the intellectual political analysis I got from reading about feminism and emerging gay history. There wasn't really queer theory there. And my lived experience, and turn that into art making, because that's the way that I was making sense of the world, not necessarily through scholarship. And although I consider myself an activist, I'm not a community organizer. I can't organize myself. I'm not persuasive. But I found a world where I was in conversation with people and didn't feel crazy. And really, it was the first time. And doing this book, I realized a lot of the women that came of age at the same time I did in the 70s and 80s were also having this feeling that, you know, the way that they experienced often their gender and sexual identity and their feminism was a feeling that they were crazy. Mm. And that was an undercurrent. They just, the world didn't make sense. Their sense of injustice felt like possibly it's a psychological problem. And it's really different to be in a group where you really get sort of affirmation, like, no, there is a patriarchy. No, you know, sexuality is important, and it doesn't necessarily fit into one of these two neat understandings. And I mean it not figuratively, I mean it quite literally, that I felt very adrift. And I see that a lot of my peers at the time also felt adrift until we found a community.
Originally, when you started in, you wanted to go backstage, and then it was like, well, there really is no backstage. And then you got to a point that you were so involved that you were struggling with burnout.
Right. So I showed up at the original Wow Cafe, which was a tiny storefront theater, really small. I mean, I think it was 12 feet wide. And it was what they call in New York the floor through. So there's windows in the front and there's windows in the back, and it's just a series of rooms you walk through. And I showed up at the Wow to see a play, and it was like a world that I went into and I wanted to enter. And I had studied visual art at Kay and loved it. And I'd also taken a lot of English, and I wasn't an English major, but I was very interested in writing and but still thinking of myself as a visual artist, however unsuccessful I had been in that pursuit. But I went in and I just, like, I loved, this is the world that I wanted to be part of. This is the world that seemed to have my real family. I felt very estranged from my family and my parents. I think that was very typical of LGBT people of my generation, that most of us, that was the common story, that you separated from your family or they kicked you out. And I just didn't want to leave. It was wonderful. It was transformative. And I tried to find the person in charge, and nobody seemed to be in charge. So I just went to the tallest person, Peggy Shaw, who looked a lot like James Dean. In fact, a dead ringer for James Dean. And I told her I wanted to volunteer, and she sort of interpreted that as like I wanted to do a show. And I was like, no, I'm not a performer. I don't do that. I'm an artist, and maybe I can work backstage. But it was one room. There was no backstage, really. So the next thing I knew, I was sort of a victim of my Midwestern nice background, where I couldn't stand up for myself and really say, like, no, I'm not a performer. Let me do something else. It was assumed you would be a performer. And I found myself agreeing to do a show in April. But this was a happy accident because I concocted some crazy array of things that I wanted to do. They were super talented people at Wow, always, who agreed to be in this really ridiculous stew of some good ideas and some just really embarrassing ideas. But when you have great performers, even your worst idea looks, you know, can be fun. And I loved it. I loved that experience. I got excited, and I kind of moved in that direction.
It seems like it was a soft place to fall for all the women there. And I have to think part of that was you really didn't have any way of judging, or didn't want to. There were no auditions. It's like if you have a play, get up there and do it.
Yes, I think that's a good comment, because I think the way that Wow was, and as far as I know, is still organized, is really innovative, really inclusive, and really extraordinary, in that there were no auditions, there was no gatekeeping, there was no coming to Wow with your letter of introduction from your theater professor and your theater degree or any of that sort of stuff. You showed up on a Tuesday night at the weekly staff meetings, and you just started working, and you got the opportunity to present whatever you wanted to present by sweat equity, by doing the hard work of supporting other people, helping them load in their sets, run their lights, you know, doing various other support work. And there was no quality control. It was, all of us had been shut out, you know, because of having an anarchic, rebellious, brave, in-your-face kind of sensibility that I think is, it's really necessary to make artwork. So we didn't want to, we wanted to create as much freedom and as few rules as possible for each other. So you worked, you went to a retreat, you pitched doing a show. Your idea was really discussed in terms of like, had you been a good citizen of the, rather than like, you know, well, this wasn't good enough quality, or you didn't get enough ticket sales, or any of these kinds of things. So the fact that the rent was so low meant that, you know, nobody made money working at WOW, but you didn't necessarily lose a bunch of money. You could have free rehearsal space. Everybody worked for free, and everybody paid to go to the shows. So that's how we stayed alive. That's so extraordinary. It never happens. I mean, implicit in that idea was that people get better by doing work. There were no, you know, talkbacks or sessions after a show to evaluate whether it was good or bad. I mean, certainly people talked, like, I hated that, or I loved that, or, you know, this person is out to lunch. But you immediately, like, poured everything into doing the next show.
Now, you've said WOW made people like Tina Fey and Shonda Rhimes possible. Explain that.
Well, I think that the generation of WOW that's covered in this book is kind of our feminist queer artists that preceded people like Tina Fey, Shonda Rhimes, Jill Soloway, these women that are making, you know, history now. And I think innovative ideas and new territory gets opened up at the grassroots. It doesn't happen in Hollywood and then spread out from there. So I think WOW was part of a zeitgeist in terms of like what was happening in queer performance and also in feminist performance that was moving away maybe from a more sort of earnest voice that centered on narratives of authenticity and more towards a like comic, hyperbolic, satirical voice. Not that there wasn't feminist comedy before that, but at WOW, comedy was really, it was really our lingua franca. And we borrowed really heavily from gay male theater traditions of camp and exaggeration, and then sort of put it through our own like feminist lens. And so I'm sure that none of those people that I mentioned, Tina Fey, Shonda Rhimes, probably ever heard of WOW, but I think it nevertheless was, you know, one manifestation of a sea change, of a creation of an audience, a sensibility that spread out from small places to a larger part of America, and made it possible for the points of view and sensibility of people like Tina Fey and Shonda Rhimes and various other innovators to reach a broader audience. And some of the people that worked at WOW, notably people like Lisa Crone and Eileen Miles and Lois Weaver, Peggy Shaw, Carmelita Tropicana, had moved out of WOW and had broader impacts. And it's easy to forget how little opportunities there were for women, even white, straight women, in 1982 to make work. The culture industry is still dominated by white, cisgendered men with money. But at that time, it was pretty much, we're pretty much frozen out with a few examples. So where was the training grounds for women to develop their work and to develop it without a sense of judgment? And WOW was one of those places. Alison Bechdel talks how she came to cartooning, she was a, you know, she had studied visual art and she had studied writing when she was in college in Oberlin. And then when she moved out of college, she kept getting rejected when, you know, when she was trying to submit stories or art, and she just wasn't making the grade. And she looked for a place where she felt like she could more safely develop her voice. And that was cartooning, because there wasn't a critical lens on it. So I think the fact that WOW was a bit off the map and was kind of not getting attention was both a symptom of various biases, but also an opportunity for people to develop.
Now, you've touched on this a little bit already, but if I would like to go a little deeper into this. As a feminist, as a lesbian, talk about the changes you've witnessed in your lifetime, both personally and in a career in the arts, and what you'd like to see next. What are the next steps for us?
Well, as a gay person, there's like extraordinary changes, which is not to say that everything is fixed, far be it. But I remember when I was in college, it was one thing to be out with my friends, but, you know, there wouldn't have been a place for that to even been discussed in a class. It certainly in any way that wouldn't have, I mean, there's just, it was been unthinkable. And I think even claiming space as a feminist would have been somewhat unthinkable. And so I lived a good part of my adult life under a situation where extremely risky to claim your identity. LGBT discrimination ranged from being denied housing and employment to physical safety and psychological. I would say that all of my friends who came out in my generation, and I'm about to be 61, I mean, the psychological price we paid, even if we were white, middle class people who could pass as women, as straight women, I think we suffered a lot of psychological damage from having to police our identity, being afraid. And also from estrangement from our families. I mean, there's a few people that I know of my generation that had good relationships with their family, but that was the exception. Family institutionalized you. Your family disowned you, set shiva for you. You moved away from your family in the feeling that you had to save their life, or you related to your family, but you could, you know, never bring a partner home. You had to lie about your life. This is like, it's not as if this has completely changed, but I think that it's not. I hear other stories from my college age students now, although there is incredible discrimination that persists, and particularly for non-gender conforming LGBT people and LGBT people of color, and a lot of disparities in healthcare. But a huge shift that's just happened really in the last few years. That's kind of incredible, a little disorienting because so much of my experience was shaped around discrimination and marginalization, and then the rich subcultures that grew up in response to discrimination. So it's a weird moment. I think as a feminist, it's a very difficult moment. There's certainly a lot of women who have made professional strides. I mean, we just had a woman president, a woman of color president at Kay, which was very exciting. And I had very few women professors when I was at Kay, and, you know, I can think of maybe one woman of color faculty that I remember. Mixed bag.
Talk about theater's role, what that role can be, what it is maybe for you personally in instigating social change, or at very least raising awareness. What has that experience been for you?
So circling back to my formative post-graduation from Kalamazoo College days at the New York Feminist Art Institute, I felt that art was a venue where feminism and other political commitments really came to life. And there was thinking, there was research, there was advocacy that was happening in that work. There was a very vibrant, in the 70s and somewhat into the 80s, feminist art movement. I think that I have seen in my more than 30 years working in theater and performance, like incredibly thoughtful, innovative, provocative, confusing work done about gender and sexuality and race in theater and performance, usually on the margins. So people, you know, in the margins, in sort of what's performance art, experimental art, in some of the places where I performed, like Performance Space 122 and PS 122, Dixon Place, some of these other venues besides WOW, there was a great freedom to experiment. And they're not trying to please the subscriber base. The ticket prices tended to be lower or very low. And the audience really wanted to be pushed and to be challenged. And mainstream theater has been more resistant to just even having work by women and people of color produced, women directing stuff. Even the roles for women in some of the shows seem sort of trapped in stereotypes about ingenues and certain kinds of wives. Fringe work, a lot of exciting experimentation has happened, but like a big moment, things have started to shift. They've started to break open. And the questioning about gender and sexuality, the challenges around race and class, has started to move out of these more fringe places into more mainstream venues. And I point to like Fun Home as an example, to see Fun Home, the book written by Lisa Crome, to see it first at the Public Theater. And she has this one anthem that I think all of my friends adore, Ring of Keys, sung by a child actor. And it's about a moment where a young person, a young lesbian, sees another lesbian who's a UPS delivery person. And it's not just that this person is a lesbian, it's a different way of being a woman. It's a different kind of gender presentation. And there's this moment of recognition and identification. And it's a wonderful song. And I saw it in the Public Theater. And by the time I'd seen it, it wasn't just filled with gay people. There were lots of ordinary theater subscribers. It was packed. And I felt people got it. I mean, this was a very central experience, I think, for a lot of gay women that I think was probably invisible, unfamiliar, and possibly challenging to most heterosexual people a few years before. But suddenly people are enjoying it. They're identifying with this young lead actress. They see the humor and they see the possibility in it. And that's something I never thought I would see. Ring of Keys was presented on last year's Tony Awards show. So it obviously had a lot of, you know, popularity across the board. It's not just an individual story. There's ideas about different ways to be a woman, different ways what gender identity looks like. They're celebrating she has short hair, she's wearing pants, she looks really strong, and she has a big ring of keys. And I think the ideas that are embedded in that are much larger than the wonderful graphic novel that Alison Bechdel wrote or the, you know, wonderful production that Lisa Crome created. But that bubbled up from theater.
Did men have a role at WOW at all?
Well, one of the ways that WOW was really different than other feminist and lesbian organizations of the time is it was never a separatist space. So men were allowed to come. And again, there was this real spirit of like, you know, we had been victim of all sorts of rules from the patriarchy to even well-intentioned political organizations. However, what role WOW could have, or what role men could have at WOW was open to question. And there were some people that interpreted WOW to mean that, you know, men couldn't be performers. Other people had men as performers. I think there was a general sense that WOW was not a place for men to be the lead creators on a piece. Although my co-editor, Carmelita Tropicana, collaborated several times with a man, Usi Parnes, on her productions. I should also point out that this is a different conversation in 2016 than it was in 1983, before really the emergence of trans discourse. So we kind of thought we knew what a woman was and what a man was at that time, although there were some trans people that came through WOW. I don't think we really had a language around it.
When you put this book together, did it unearth anything unexpected for you, stir up old yearnings perhaps for some place like that again in your life? And I'm wondering too about your hopes for this book, what you hope that it will convey to its readers.
Good questions. I think that one of the things that really came up as I was, going through the work, I thought a lot of the work is just incredibly funny, and I think it's still funny. I mean, there may be some dated moments in it, but I think often the work was ahead of its time and is still fresh. And I've worked on this project for a long time, had students working on it, and they'll confirm that, so that, you know, wow, this is really funny. I think that the other thing that came out in interviews was over and over again how so many women, I mean, all of the women I interviewed talked about like how pivotal WOW was for them, how WOW probably saved their lives in different ways. And at the same time, a lot of them felt that they had to hide some aspect of their identity, or it wasn't fully embraced. And I think, you know, there were, as feminists of that generation, we didn't have the sort of intersectional feminist language to help us sort of think through the multiple identities we all embody. So, you know, there were bigger sort of splits around, I think, around Jewish women who felt like, you know, the place tilted in a Christian direction, although there was certainly no religiosity present, but that's not the only way that that can manifest itself. There were women who, you know, there was a woman who grew up in the projects and felt that, you know, her experience of growing up in that kind of poverty was something that she didn't feel like she could really talk about at WOW. Some of us came from New York. A lot of us came from a lot of other places. I think most people had this sense of not being fully embraced. What I would say, two things, is that my experience of being around feminist organizations is that sometimes we expect too much. You know, the feminist organization is the mom who's supposed to accept and understand all of us. Mm. So I think there's sometimes an unrealistic expectation of what a feminist organization can offer. I think, you know, certainly the insights of intersectional feminism now maybe give people more language to think about differences in a productive way. One thing that was really on the front burner since the early days of WOW was that, you know, it was primarily, when it started, not an entirely white organization, but largely white women who stayed, and, you know, with some notable exceptions. Why we were so white, what that meant, what we could do about it, was a conversation that was always in circulation. It wasn't dismissed. There was real wrestling with it. One of the ways that WOW tried to grapple with it was by kind of like opening up the resource that we had to lesbians of color. So, for example, the East Coast Asian lesbians, we allowed them, we offered our space for free for regular programming. So they could do, you know, they had, I can't remember if it was once a month, maybe it was once a week. They had regular programming at WOW that they could use in whatever way they wanted to use. And we also did series where we, you know, produced on a very low level of production because we had no money and we had no personnel. But we would invite women of color. They didn't have to come in and like be part of our collective. And I think that was actually a good solution for WOW at that time. I've been in other feminist organizations where like panic and it's like, oh my God, we're all white. And so then, you know, you try to rope in some people of color into your organization and get them to sign on to an agenda you've already established. And that's just not, that never works well. But one thing that has happened as in the more recent times when I've gone back to WOW, WOW is now, I don't know if it's 50% of color, but I would say go to the WOW homepage. You know, WOW today is much more diverse. I'm not sure there's, you know, WOW is not a place that keeps statistics, but if you go to the website, if you look at the shows that are being offered there, you look at, you go to a meeting, you go to a show, you see that like people of color have a very, very sizable role in what WOW is today, as do trans people. And I'm not sure how that happened. Did WOW shift? Did the community shift? What happened? I think that those changes were probably larger than WOW and reflected in this organization, but, you know, it's really great to see.
Now, today you're a professor in the Department of Theater and Drama at University of Michigan. Talk a little bit about your work there. Are you able to incorporate some of the lessons you've learned at WOW into classrooms of today?
Sure. I do. I am a professor in the Department of Theater and Drama. My principal appointment is in the Penny W. Stamp School of Art and Design. And I also have an appointment in women's studies. So it's surprising because my career trajectory is not one that would suggest that becoming a professor is a logical next step. But nevertheless, here I am. Yeah, I think that what I try to bring from my early experience in feminist and queer pedagogy, and WOW was a teaching place as well as a performance space. I'm really interested in uncovering what my students want to say, what their desires are, what's burning and big inside them, and helping them to put that in a larger context. And I think that some of the questions that might have been big and difficult for me to unearth around my sexuality are less so for some of my students, but it doesn't mean that they don't have similar struggles of trying to, especially my students who are not white, my students who are not male, students who are not cisgendered, students who might come from poverty or other experiences of marginalization. There's a process of feeling that you have a voice that can be heard and respected. I think sometimes arts education, broadly defined, focuses on the necessary aspect of skill building to the exclusion of content, and all of it to the exclusion of putting the art making we're doing in a larger context. So I think I see all the time students, I teach two classes right now where students are working on self-directed projects in any medium, and it's all of their life has prepared them for really prescribed assignments that teach them about color theory or how to use Final Cut Pro, or so they've learned all these like technical skills. They often experience the opportunity to say something, to develop their own ideas, is like kind of overwhelming for them. And so I think that's a contribution that I bring.
And what about you? What are you doing in theater now? Are you still performing? Are you writing?
Yeah, I'm still performing. I'm still writing. Well, I'm producing a lot of events around this book. Basically, four events in New York City that bring all the contributors from the book together to perform, and doing a panel discussion at New York University's Fail Library, which is a special collection devoted to experimental avant-garde New York artwork. We have an exciting panel there. So I'm doing a lot of work about that sort of, you know, not just publishing the book, but trying to get it out there in the world and call attention to some of the great artists out there. I'm working with Chicago's Victory Gardens Theater to create a performance lab. And I'm working on a new performance piece that hopefully will come to the surface in the next year or two. I have some wonderful opportunities this year. In October, I was part of the first gay performance event in Poland, in Lublin, Poland, a city that has a history of having an important avant-garde performance festival, but a place where LGBT rights are just not an expression, or just not where they are in a lot of other places in Eastern Europe. So that was a really exciting opportunity to be part of that. And some of my WOW colleagues, like Lois Weaver and Peggy Shaw, were part of that. That was really wonderful. So I have a lot of different irons in the fire, partially making my own work, partially curating. And I'm also a former student of mine at Michigan in the Penny W. Stamps program, Joseph Keckler, who is a native of Kalamazoo, but went to Michigan. Is kind of recreating new opera theater in New York, and I'm writing about his work. So a nice full circle to see someone who I knew was a very young person, who was just kind of developing but had extraordinary skills, and to be in conversation with him as he really makes some new exciting work that's getting recognition. So what I'm dying to share is that WOW still exists. It's still happening. It's, can find it easily on the web. And I think that it's great to pay attention to the work that happens and is happening at WOW, because of some of the people like Eileen Miles and Lisa Crone, who have emerged from WOW, but also, the longevity of WOW and WOW as a community space is also a different kind of success that needs celebration. So that's what I have to say.